holds the electric vibration, so it's a problem.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for coming. Okay, yeah, so this is a talk about, well, which will be about manifolds, so spaces of various dimensions, culminating in the four-dimensional ones, which are where the fun stuff happens. All right, so this is some sort of an overview of what the talk's going to contain before we get down to it. So I'm going to introduce this idea of a gadget called a smooth manifold. So this is some mathematical notion of a space in which you can move around, and you have a certain number of sort of degrees of freedom. So just in three-dimensional space, you have 3 degrees of freedom, and in an n-dimensional manifold, you have n degrees of freedom to move around in. So these are gadgets in which one has some idea of dimension. But somehow, although locally you're just sort of moving around in n dimensions, globally there's some much more complicated structure. Perhaps I should just sort of say a word about, you know, how mathematicians use these words like dimension. It's a bit like the way mathematicians use the word infinite or infinity. You know, somehow some philosophers might think that there's some absolute Platonic notion of infinity out there, but that's not at all the way that mathematicians work. Mathematicians actually sort of come up with all sorts of ways of very precise ways of using the notion infinity in different contexts, and don't attempt to give some overarching definition that applies to all of them. And similarly, I don't really know some absolute Platonic notion of dimension, but I do know various situations in which dimension seems like a good word to use for the thing that we're trying to describe. Okay, so I make no sort of promise that what I will talk about in terms of dimension is exactly the same as what you might have seen in some other contexts. So we're going to start with two-dimensional manifolds, and those are quite easy to picture, and there'll be lots of pictures. And so then the goal is going to be that we can progress from two-dimensional to higher-dimensional, three- and four-dimensional manifolds. But we're going to do that by using the two-dimensional ones that we can picture and some additional data on those. So it's going to be really a way of getting our hands on these sort of complicated three- and four-dimensional things using pictures. And so the constructions that I'll describe are somehow part of the working toolkit for topologists, geometric topologists, and geometers more generally. So here we go. All right, so we'll start with a familiar picture. So here's the Earth viewed from space. So it's a sphere. Well, there, pretty much, it's a sphere. If we want to view the Earth in space, well, we could set up some coordinate system, and the most obvious thing to do for these purposes is to set up a geocentric coordinate system, meaning I erect x, y, and z axes sort of centered in the middle of the Earth. And now I'm interested in not in the bulk, but just in the surface of the Earth for this discussion. Call that S. And, you know, in suitable units, it's cut out as the solutions to an equation that's, well, in a good approximation, it would be x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals 1, the familiar equation of a sphere. Now, in some more precise model, you might want to add on some little correction term to the left-hand side of that equation to take into account the fact that the Earth is not perfectly spherical, but that's not going to matter much to us. So that's a way of representing the surface of the Earth, and it's a way that we could describe as extrinsic. What do I mean? So What it means is that we see this surface as sitting inside this ambient three-dimensional space. Okay, so we don't see just the surface itself, but rather we see the three dimensions of space in which it sits. We see these x, y, and z of R3, of which S is some subset. Okay. Well, there's another very traditional way of representing the Earth that I suppose predates that one, and this one is intrinsically two-dimensional. And so here we represent the surface of the Earth not in a single image, but in a whole book's worth of images, in the pages of an atlas. Okay, so what does it mean? Well, each page gives us, each chart, if you like, gives us a picture of some region in the Earth. On that region, I have a perfectly two-dimensional representation of it. Here you have a representation of India and neighboring countries, and I could perfectly well just talk about an x-coordinate and a y-coordinate, and that will locate me somewhere on this picture. Okay. Similarly, here's the next page, and we see China and some neighboring countries. So as mathematicians, there's an aspect of an atlas which sort of appeals to us and sort of seems important to us that might seem rather unimportant to someone who's actually using an atlas to look at what to look at what's going on there, and that's the fact that these the pages of this atlas, the charts overlap. So mathematically, that's absolutely critical. So, for instance, it might be too small for you to see, but okay, so here's Mount Everest marked on this one. And so in this chart, that would have a certain x-coordinate and a certain y-coordinate. But we see it again in this picture somewhere. There it is. So this has a rather different x-coordinate and a rather different y-coordinate in this picture. But it's crucial that there is that overlap. There are some points that lie in both charts. Okay. So let's try and say this in a sort of in a mathematical way, a reasonably precise mathematical way. So each page P of our atlas is, well, it's some subset of the plane R2. Meaning the set of pairs of numbers, x, y, giving us coordinates. So here's one subset and here's another. And sometimes, so this, you know, one page P and another page Q overlap. Sometimes they, you know, you might have two that don't overlap at all, but these two overlap. And so that means that there's a certain subset of P which also appears in Q, and there's a certain subset of Q which also appears in P. Okay, so I'm calling P primed the subset of P that appears in Q, and Q primed the subset of Q that appears in P. So those are the two; those are the overlap regions as we see them on the two charts. And then there was this business that we can take some point in the overlap region on P, like Mount Everest, and identify it with I don't think I pointed to the right place exactly, but we can identify it with the corresponding point in Q primed. So that's to say, there's some mapping from P primed to Q primed that sends a point of P primed to the corresponding point in Q primed. Okay. So it sends Mount Everest to Mount Everest. Okay, so that's just some mapping that I'm calling phi sub PQ. From P prime to Q primed, so it expresses the change of coordinates, and it's another sort of facet of an aspect of that that's important for this theory, is that phi PQ is smooth. That's to say, it's differentiable. So it's just a function from a bit of R2 to a bit of R2. So we can talk about derivatives, you know, partial derivatives and so forth, and it's going to be a smooth mapping. And that's the property that mathematicians abstract. So here's a more sort of schematic kind of an atlas for some planet. So here I've got 9 different charts. All right. So these are the maps. Okay. Each of them is just a square, and I've drawn each of them a different color, red, orange, yellow, and so on. These strips on the edges of the squares are supposed to depict the overlap regions. So, for instance, this basically red square overlaps this basically orange square, because this strip here corresponds to this strip here. So the map phi here would just sort of take this thin strip and move it along to identify with this one. Okay? So similarly, this one overlaps with this one, and you know this one overlaps with this one, and so forth. But moreover, this one here also overlaps with this one here. Namely, this strip along this edge counts for the same as this strip along this edge. So it sort of wraps around the back. And similarly, this sort of purplish strip here at the top counts for the overlaps with this one here and sort of counts for the same as that. Okay, so that's a sort of abstract atlas for some strange planet. So it's these overlap mappings that allow us to take to sort of piece together these individual charts and understand what the overall structure is. And let's take a look at it. So look at the left image. What I've done here is I've simply sort of I've just run these together. The adjacent ones come together where they overlap. So I've just conglomerated them into a single square, okay, and in this image I've just got rid of the colours, which are now not important, but I'm not done yet, because at this stage there was still the business that this strip here overlaps with this strip here. And I haven't really carried out that identification yet. So when I see this picture here, I still have this whole purple top strip, which overlaps and counts for the same as the purple strip at the bottom. Similarly, the strips on the two edges really overlap one another. So, you know, so then we can try and see what that should look like when we sort of piece things together along the overlaps. Well, what's going to happen is, suppose I try and identify this one with this one. If you think of cutting this thing out of paper, you wrap it round, and it makes a cylinder. And then you have trouble with your paper model, because now you want to identify the top and the bottom of the cylinder. But if you do it, what you get is this. You get a torus. So what I've done here is that I took this square, and first of all I wanted to identify the two edges of it, so I rolled it up so as to make a cylinder, which is what I get when I identify this edge with this edge. But then I take the top of this one and I want to identify it with the bottom, so I sort of wrap it around, and now what happens is that it becomes this torus. So by giving this funny atlas, what I was doing was somehow encoding by those overlaps this particular surface, this torus that's going to come up a lot in this talk. It's going to be denoted by this blackboard bold T. Okay. Let me pause. Yeah, questions. Yes. Yes.
Do you differentiate between the two?
No, you don't. In fact, somehow, if we go back to this picture, we're sort of this is not really sort of giving instructions for making a paper model, but rather what it's saying is that you take this square, but you consider a point like this to count the same as a point like this, and a point like this to count the same as a point like that. And so in some sense you can perform those identifications one at a time or simultaneously, and it really doesn't matter. Any more questions before I go on? So now here's the sort of formal bit that is supposed to encapsulate what we just did. Okay, so a surface, or more precisely a smooth surface, well, it's some sort of an entity S. More on that in a moment. It's an eraser, yes. So it's some sort of an entity. Let's use this one as a working picture. And you can cover the whole of it with little patches like this one, which are basically just little sort of open sets in R2. They're planar. And they overlap one another and sort of cover the whole of this gadget. Like so. And so if you take a point in an overlap region, you can think of it as a part of the yellow patch or a part of the red patch, and there's some smooth mapping that says, how do I go from the yellow coordinates to the red coordinates? So we take an atlas, which is just a bunch of little patches in R2, and we give these overlap maps that say, this is the way that we're going to piece them together. Okay. So there's one aspect of this which was sort of very vague, which was that I used this word entity and didn't say what it was. So at this point, I'm going to appeal to something which you may or may not have studied at this point. It's the idea of a topological space. So there's a language for the right sort of entities before you can start doing this. And I'm going to sweep that under the rug. Yeah, bunch of patches. They're just little regions in R2. You have a way of going from the coordinates in one patch to another patch, and that way is expressed by a smoother differentiable mapping. So basic examples. So here's this torus T. It'll keep coming back. Another basic one that we considered would be the sphere. It's denoted by S2. Two for two-dimensional, because intrinsically it's two-dimensional. We have 2 degrees of freedom as we wander around on this sphere. And so on the one hand, we can think about it by just an equation like this, x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals 1, cut out as a subset of R3. And on the other hand, we could think of it in terms of this atlas of charts where we... where did I put the colored chalk? There. Where we cover it by, you know, mapping out little patches like this, enough to cover the whole of the surface. Okay, so that's what a surface is. All right, and now, there's this number 2, which comes up a couple of times in this definition. And now mathematicians will not be sort of satisfied to sort of let that go and leave it as a 2 if it could be other things. So now a manifold, a smooth manifold of some dimension n, is some sort of an entity. I'm not immediately going to be able to draw a picture for you for higher dimensions. But it sort of works in the same way. You have... The whole entity, so really it's a topological space. It's covered by little patches. So for instance, in 3 dimensions, the patches would just be little 3-dimensional balls like this one. So you're supposed to think of the bulk of this one now. It's a solid, not just a surface. We could have coordinates centered in the middle of that. And so that's what a 3-dimensional manifold looks like. Locally, that's what one of the charts or patches looks like. But now you have a bunch of those, and they're connected up in some way. They have overlaps. And you have some smooth functions that express how you go from the coordinates in one patch to the coordinates in another patch. And that's what a mathematician's notion of a smooth n-dimensional object is. So, just like in two dimensions, you get examples of these things, and I suppose this is why really people started studying them in the first place around, I don't know, they started studying them in the circa 1900, I guess, or just before. And you know, for them, they initially came about as solutions to equations. So, for instance, there's an n-dimensional manifold called the n-dimensional sphere, Sn. And what it is you look at those points, those lists of n plus 1 real numbers, x0 through xn, with the property that the sum of the squares is equal to 1. So that means that the n plus 1 dimensional distance to the origin is 1. So it's a sort of, it's like a sphere. And you can prove that that has the structure of a smooth n manifold. Well, Sn is, you know, you can visualize it in low dimensions. So if we start in zero dimensions, so then we just have x0 squared equals 1. So x0 is plus or minus 1. So then I just have two points, 1 and you know, minus 1 and 1. So that's S0. S1, well, then you have x0 squared plus x1 squared is 1. So that amounts to a circle. S2 is the sphere. And now S3, well, S3 is three-dimensional, and so you think, okay, I can visualize this, it's three-dimensional. But it's not so easy. It's not so easy for the following reason. I can very easily visualize a little piece of the three-dimensional sphere. It's just ordinary three-dimensional space. But that's not the whole of it. I haven't covered the whole of it. All I've done is covered one of these little charts. The whole thing is a bunch of those stuck together in some non-trivial way, and that makes it more of a challenge to visualize and work with. All right. Yeah, okay, so that's the end of that section. Let me take any more questions. So, so repeating what I said in the introductory slide, I guess, we're going to start in earnest with surfaces, two-dimensional manifolds, like S2 and the torus T. And now we're going to see how you can progress to these sort of more inaccessible, higher dimensional gadgets. So we're going to show how to get from 2 to 3 to 4 dimensions. And the way it's going to go is something like this. If you take a surface and you find a symmetry of it, and I have to say what I mean by a symmetry of a surface, well, that's going to give rise to a three-dimensional manifold by a certain procedure. Okay, so a symmetry of a two-dimensional thing will give us a three-dimensional thing. And then, you know, how do you get to 4? Well, so then it'll turn out that if you have a relation between two symmetries, so if you have two symmetries that look different but are somehow actually the same, it's going to give rise to a four-dimensional object. Okay, so that's our goal. Okay, so there's a bit of ground to cover to get there. Okay, so I think I should tell you what I mean by a symmetry here. So what's a symmetry? So suppose you have a couple of manifolds. Look, I have two here handily, T2 and so the torus and the sphere. And suppose I have some mapping from this one to this one. So that's to say, it's a function. So each point in this one gives a point in this one. Okay. And I want it to be a continuous function, first of all. So if I vary this point a bit, then the corresponding point in the image will also just vary a bit. Okay. So there's a notion of what it means for such a function to be smooth. And it's actually something, it's pretty simple. What it means is this. It means that you look at it in coordinates. You look at one of these charts. In these charts I have coordinates, x and y. So I'm interested in what the function does near some point like this, which lives in the yellow chart. That maps, say, to this point in another yellow chart. So in those coordinates, my mapping is just a function from a bit of R2 to a bit of R2. I know what smoothness means for that because I've done calculus. Okay? It means it's differentiable. Infinitely differentiable. Okay? So I have a notion of smooth maps between these manifolds. And so now here's some terminology. So a diffeomorphism is a map between manifolds which actually has a smooth inverse mapping. So now this one will no longer do. In fact, there's no diffeomorphism from T to the sphere. So on the other hand, if I modify my picture and choose something like, I don't know, something with various sort of protuberances but no sort of holes, then it is possible to find a map from this one to the two sphere, which is smooth, so it's and which is invertible, so it's a one-to-one correspondence between these points, and it's smooth and it has a smooth inverse. And now, by a symmetry of a manifold, what I mean is a self-diffeomorphism. I mean it's a smooth map that's a diffeomorphism, but the source and the target are one and the same. So, for example, I'm looking at this bullet point. So, that one of the simplest manifolds I can think of is R, the real line. It's a one-dimensional manifold. And so, what are the symmetries of R as a real manifold, as a one-dimensional manifold? Well, they're supposed to be functions from R to R. They're supposed to be smooth, so infinitely differentiable in the usual sense of calculus. And I want them to be invertible with smooth inverse. So the way that I achieve that is that I need that the derivative of my function should be, well, either it should be everywhere positive, and then I want the function to go off to plus infinity and minus infinity as I go to infinity and minus infinity, or I want the derivative to be always negative. Okay, so. I don't want any zeros for the derivative. And so manifolds have abundant symmetries. How abundant? Well, so for example, suppose I take any manifold like this sphere, and the way this is going to go is that you pick 1,000 points, so U1, U2, U3, up to U1,000, distinct points, and I pick 1,000 points, so I1, I2, and so on, up to I1,000. Well, when I say that they're abundant, it's possible to find a diffeomorphism that will take I1 to U1, and I2 to U2, and I3 to U3, and so forth, whatever those points may be. So there are really a lot of these things. Pictures of those on slides coming up, actually. Okay. So that's what I meant by symmetries. And remember, the claim from the previous slide was that a symmetry of a surface is going to give rise to some three-dimensional object. So a self-diffeomorphism of a surface will give rise to a three-dimensional object. Okay. Okay, so now, so let's talk some more about surfaces. Okay, so some technical conditions. The surfaces that we'll consider, so first they're compact. So if you've been to a course on topology, you'll know that word. Maybe if you've been to a course on analysis, you will. Basically, it means that it you can stick it inside some Rn for n very big, and it's a closed and bounded subset. So I'm not going. Somehow it's a finite condition on the a finiteness condition on the manifold, and I'm not going to say much about it. There's also an orientability condition. Let me skip lightly over this for reasons of time. But orientability means that the kinds of weirdness that you might have encountered with Möbius strips and Klein bottles and things won't impinge on us. Okay. And then there's a famous theorem that says that if you have any surface of this kind, compact and orientable, well, it is diffeomorphic, so somehow it's equivalent as a manifold to some standard issue surface sigma g of genus g. I'll tell you what it means for some positive number g, non-negative number g. So here's the picture. Yeah. So this is the same restatement of the theorem. So you take some random surface that comes to you, however, like in this model, and then you can say that as a manifold, it's identical to some standard issue thing. So this is the standard issue genus 3 surface. It's a sort of blob with three holes in it. Okay. The genus 0 surface would just be the 2-sphere. So that's all there are surface in terms of surfaces. So those we can picture, we can work with those. Okay, and now we're going to talk about symmetries of surfaces. So let's take our compact orientable surface. So like it, you know, so you may as well think that it's one of these. And okay, so we're going to look at self-diffeomorphism. So remember, these are smoothly invertible maps from this surface to itself. So think of this picture as just a little piece of your surface, and what it's indicating is the sort of thing that can happen with diffeomorphisms. So if you imagine that you started out with a perfectly straightforward square grid here, and it's been sort of twisted and deformed, so you know, the point which has had sort of grid coordinates 2, 2 has sort of moved from where it originally was a little bit to this one. Okay, so you have so these are symmetries, and symmetries always form a group. It means you can compose them and get another symmetry, and you can invert them and you get another symmetry. So you have this gigantic group, an infinite group, diff plus sigma of self diffeomorphisms of sigma, orientation preserving. Never mind. And inside that there's a subgroup. So there are some diffeomorphisms which are singled out by a certain property. And the property is that you can get to those ones by starting with the identity map, which means you do absolutely nothing to your surface, and then you just deform it. So, for instance, in this picture, you could have started with doing nothing, for which I would have just drawn the square grid, and I've just kind of twisted that a bit, so I could get to this by a sort of smooth deformation, starting with doing nothing at all. And so those form a subgroup of this symmetry group, so that's diff 0. And okay, and then there's a quotient group, so gamma of sigma. It's called the mapping class group. So what is it? So it's the group of symmetries, so self-diffeomorphisms, except that two self-diffeomorphisms count the same if you can get from one to the other just by smoothly deforming the map. Okay, so let's see some pictures to see how this works in practice. Okay, so let's see how this works for the torus. Okay, this is a picture of the torus. How is this a picture of the torus? Well, as before, so it's a picture of the square. I have this red line at the bottom, but we're supposed to think of that as being the same as this line at the top. So this point here is the same as this point here, for example. Similarly, we have a blue line down the left side and a blue line down the red side, and they count as the same. So this point here is the same as this point here. Okay. How many points does the corners do the corners account for? It's just one, right? Because this corner point here, well, it's the same as this one, but it's also the same as this one, and then this one is the same as this one. Right? Okay, and now, so it's sort of hard to really fully picture a diffeomorphism, but we can get an idea of what it does by seeing how it affects curves that are inscribed on the surface. So for instance, on this torus, I have this red curve, this sort of straight linear curve. It's the same as this one. And I might have some self-diffeomorphism phi that moves it over to some, you know, some other curve inscribed on the torus that I've pictured here. So it sort of it comes along, starts here, comes along to this point, but this point is the same as this point. And then the curve continues and continues and continues and continues, and now this point is the same as where I started. So this is a new loop on the torus. And similarly, the blue vertical one has gone to this to this loop on the torus. You can see that before we applied the diffeomorphism, they intersected at a single point. And because the diffeomorphism is an invertible function, the images must also meet at a single point, and that's what we see here. And, okay, so, and now here's the way that you can understand diffeomorphisms of the torus up to these smooth deformations. So, what you can do is that if you're given a diffeomorphism of the torus, you can cook up a 2x2 integer matrix with determinant 1. In fact, that determines a group homomorphism from the mapping class group of the torus to the group SL2Z of such matrices. And here's how it works. So for this particular diffeomorphism that I've depicted here, the matrix it's going to give is this one, 4, 1, minus 1, 0. Why so? Well, what's going on here is that I look at what the red curve does, and it goes to this sort of wiggly curve, but it wraps around the sort of x direction 4 times. So this, so that's almost once, twice, 3 times, 4 times, and then, you know, this is just the last little bit. So that's the 4 here. But that red curve also, it wraps around the vertical direction once, but sort of top to bottom rather than bottom to top. So that's a minus 1. And similarly, I look at where the blue curve goes, and its image wraps the x direction once and the y direction 0 times. So the second column of the matrix is 1, 0. And in that way, I get a matrix. And now the claim is that that process of attaching to a diffeomorphism this matrix exactly captures the mapping class group of the torus. It's an isomorphism of groups. The mapping class group of the torus is SL2Z. Somehow what's going on there is that you can take your diffeomorphism that maps these curves to wiggly things, and you can deform it in such a way that they go to straight linear curves of a certain slope, like I've depicted here. And moreover, they send this intersection point here to the corner of this one. And now what's going on here is that this one is really just here. The diffeomorphism is what I get by acting by this matrix on well, points of R2, but considered modulo integers. Okay, so conclusion. So the mapping class group of the torus is this group of integer matrices. Okay, so here's the next ingredient. This is going to give us lots more examples of diffeomorphisms. So I'm going to talk about simple closed curves. So a simple closed curve on a surface, this is easy. This is just a smooth loop inscribed on your surface that never intersects itself. Okay, and my convention here is that these darker lines are on the front and these paler ones are on the back. So here's a simple closed curve that sort of cuts this genus 3 surface into two pieces. Here's another simple closed curve that doesn't actually cut it into two pieces. These two were easy to draw, but they're not very typical. Usually simple closed curves wind around in a more complicated way, like something like that. That's a more typical example of a simple closed curve on this surface, I think. It has no self-intersections. It does come back to where it started, but it does it in some crazy way. All right. Why did I mention simple closed curves? So simple closed curves give us, they're a nice source of diffeomorphisms. How's that? Well, so if we're given a simple closed curve gamma, so this one, the red one, I'm going to define a self-diffeomorphism, and it's called the Dehn twist. It's denoted by tau sub gamma. And here's what it does. So I'm going to identify a little sort of tubular neighborhood of gamma. So I have a little tube around it. Now, outside that tube, my diffeomorphism is going to be extremely, extremely dull. It's going to do nothing whatever. It takes a point here and it sends it back to the same point. It's inside this tube that the interesting stuff is going to happen. And here's what it does. So it's going to sort of twist that region by 2 pi. So that's to say, it's going to take this circle here and it's going to rotate it by 0 degrees. It's going to take a circle sort of in between here and rotate it by, I don't know, 90 degrees. It's going to rotate the red circle by 180 degrees. And finally, it's going to rotate this circle by 360 degrees, which means that it's doing nothing at all to it. So then I can continue on sort of doing absolutely nothing. So in this picture, what I've done is I've drawn the tube, and I've drawn a bunch of curves running through it, and we can see what happens to them when we apply this twisting operation. So for instance, if I look at this middle blue curve, what it does is that it wraps around the back, and then it eventually emerges again. So in sort of going across there, it sort of wraps all the way around this cylinder. So that's a Dehn twist. All right. And it turns out that everything, any surface diffeomorphism, arises from Dehn twists, in the sense that what you do is you specify a whole list, an ordered list of simple closed curves on your surface. You do the Dehn twist around the first one, then you compose that with the Dehn twist around the second one, and so forth. And it turns out that that up to sort of deformation, so in this mapping class group, you can get to any diffeomorphism that way. So somehow you can get at the complexity of surface diffeomorphisms by trying to sort of break them up into these simpler pieces, these Dehn twists. So that's a theorem. It's not a unique representation. So that's to say, it sometimes happens that you compose a bunch of Dehn twists, and what you get is the trivial diffeomorphism that does nothing at all, up to isotopy. So for instance, on the torus, A and B. So A and B are my basic curves. Here's A and here's B on the torus. And if I twist along A and twist along B, and then do that whole thing 6 times over, turns out what you get is trivial. Well, it's not literally trivial as a diffeomorphism. As a diffeomorphism, it'll make an incredible mess of curves that you feed into it. But up to deformation, it's trivial. And the way that you see it is using these 2x2 matrices. So in fact, these twists along A and B correspond to these two particular matrices. And now, if you multiply those two together and then take the sixth power, you get the identity matrix. And because we know that the mapping class group of the torus is this group of matrices, that tells you what's going on. All right. Okay, finally on to three dimensions. Right, so... Okay, so I'm going to talk about three manifolds, the three-dimensional objects, but specifically I'm going to talk about the ones that are what are called fibered. And what does it mean? So I have my three-dimensional manifold Y, and I at the moment that's hard to get at. But I'm interested in the situation in which that maps down to the circle S1. And it does so in a nice way. It does so in such a way that if you're at any point in your manifold, Y, you can find little coordinates around that. You can find a chart with coordinates Y1, Y2, and Y3, in which F appears just as a simple projection. Y1, Y2, Y3 just maps to Y3. Okay, so that's some sort of still a hard definition to understand. But what it means is that your three manifold looks like this. So for each t in the circle, so for instance, is the sort of reference point 0, I can look at those points in Y which map down to this one under F. And those just form a surface, one of the objects that we've been considering. And if I look at some other point T in the circle, I get another surface, which is diffeomorphic to the first one. So I have a family of surfaces. They're all essentially the same. They're diffeomorphic to one another, sort of varying smoothly, but they're all essentially the same. And now here's what happens. So I go all the way around the circle. And for every t in the circle, I have a diffeomorphism from this sort of reference fiber to the fiber at t. And so when I get all the way back around to where I started, I get a diffeomorphism from this surface to itself. That's called the monodromy of this fibered three manifold. So what we've just seen here is that if you're given a fibered three manifold, if someone presents you with one of these things described, I don't know how, you can cook up from it a surface and a symmetry of that surface, a self-diffeomorphism of it. And on the other hand, I'll only run through this very briefly, but in the other direction, if you're given a surface and a self-diffeomorphism of it, you can construct one of these three-dimensional gadgets. And the way that you do it is that you say, well, let me take my surface and let me thicken it up by crossing it with an interval. So it's a sort of funny visual convention, but I'm just going to draw that like this. It would be better to think, really, it would be better to think of this as being sort of made of some solid material, and I go into a certain depth. And so this is now some sort of three-dimensional gadget, and it has two sort of boundary components, this one and this one. And then I glue one to the other, and I do it by my chosen self-diffeomorphism. And the result is this three-manifold, and it comes with a projection map that sort of says how far along in this direction did I go, But that's really valued in the circle, because there's an ambiguity. This is both the beginning and the end of the interval. So that construction, by the way, is called... This gadget, this three-dimensional gadget that you get from the self-diffeomorphism is called the mapping torus. And so the conclusion, which is at the bottom of this slide, is that fibered three-manifolds are interchangeable with isotopy class, so with surface diffeomorphisms, but really only their representatives in the mapping class group matter. All right, that's... Okay, so running out of time, and I'm just barely getting to the four-dimensional part of the story. Well, let me tell you a little bit about it. So here we go. So here's the fun stuff. So we've just seen that if you have a surface and a self-diffeomorphism thereof, then you can cook up from that a three-dimensional manifold together with this extra structure. It's a fibered three-manifold. So it comes as a family of surfaces parameterized by the circle. Okay, so now the next claim is this. Suppose that I give you that diffeomorphism in a very specific way. So what I'm going to do is this. So I'm going to say that mu is this diffeomorphism, and I'm going to give it as the composite of a bunch of Dane twists, these were Dane twists, along curves, simple closed curves, gamma 1 through gamma n. So I give you now just not just the surface diffeomorphism, but I give you a bunch of circles inscribed on this surface, and I say do the Dane twist along the first, second, third, and so on, so as to get a diffeomorphism, some complicated diffeomorphism. And now what I claim is that that's the right data to get an interesting four-dimensional manifold. And its relation to the fibered three-manifold is that the fibered three-manifold is its boundary. So just as... So if I draw a picture like this, there's some surface with a boundary, and the boundary here is just a circle. In some similar sense, this is going to be a four-dimensional object, and it's going to bound this three-dimensional one. And it's going to come with a structure. So it's going to be some four-dimensional gadget. But it's going to come... Well, the three-dimensional gadget came with a map to the circle, and the four-dimensional gadget is going to come with a map to the disk, so which bounds the circle, so D2, the disk. And that's how we're going to picture it. Okay, so I'll make this pretty brief. That map is going to have a special structure. It's called a Lefschetz vibration. Okay. I think what I should do is skip some details and go straight to the pictures. So I'm going to start with this picture, actually. Where did I leave the eraser? This one. So the title of this talk said sort of 2 + 2 = 4. And so the way that I like to think about four-dimensional manifolds is by 2 + 2 = 4. So I like to think of a four-dimensional object as arising by staking a two-dimensional object like a surface like this two-sphere, and thinking of a whole family of surfaces that are parameterized by the points of that base surface. So for each point of the two-sphere, I have some surface. And so I have sort of two dimensions in the base, and I have two dimensions in the fibers, and together they make up four dimensions. Okay. And so the sort of interesting examples have have the following structure. So it's not the case that quite all the fibers look identical. Most of the fibers look like this. They're just sort of genus 3 or genus G surfaces. But there are some that are special. This is what the story of Lefschetz vibrations is about. And those ones are... Well, so what happens is that there's some curve in the surface that sort of gets pinched, and you get a singular point like this one. And so... I think I should at least sort of state the thing that I wanted to get to, even though I didn't quite make it in terms of details. It's this. So my claim is this. Suppose you have a bunch of Dehn twists, and you do all of them, and suppose that somehow that you end up by getting the identity. So for instance, on the torus, we had this example that you could take tor A, tor B, and do that a bunch of times, like you could do it, say, 12 times, and you'll get the identity. So here's my claim. My claim is that by writing down an equation like this, you're specifying enough data to... make a four-dimensional manifold, which is given as a family of surfaces parameterized by the two-sphere, in which most of the fibers, the surfaces look identical, but some number of them, in fact, n, where n is the number of Dehn twists, are pinched like this one. And just give you a tiny bit about how that goes. So the way it's going to, so the relation with Dehn twist is going to be something like this. So you're going to, so this is supposed to be sort of one hemisphere of the two sphere, and you start with your reference fiber, and you're going to sort of build this four manifold with the property that if I look at what's happening over this loop here, it's going to be a fibered three-manifold, and its monodromy is going to be a Dehn twist. It's going to be the ith Dehn twist in this sequence. You compose all of them, we're interested in the case where you compose all of them and get the identity. That somehow means that when you go all the way around these loops, you end up doing nothing. And when that happens, it's possible to take that... the thing that you've created over this hemisphere and glue it to a completely sort of boring piece on this hemisphere. This is just the disk crossed with a reference surface. And glue them together and make this closed four manifold. Okay, so my timing was such that I didn't give you any details of that. So to wrap it up, given surface data you can produce first of all three manifolds and then four manifolds, you actually produce a completely definitely identifiable class of four manifolds this way that are of interest for other reasons. And so smooth four-dimensional topology, it's all about the sort of interactions between sort of geometric cut-and-paste type constructions like I've been describing and sort of more equation-based ways of describing things. And as a last word... So there have been many advances in smooth four-dimensional topology, but it remains, I think, unquestionably the least understood thing in topology or in geometric topology. And if that sounds unsurprising, let me point out that among the things that I'm comparing it to are five-dimensional topology, six-dimensional topology, a billion-dimensional topology. Four-dimensional topology is still the most mysterious and interesting, and there's lots of cool stuff to be done. All right, thank you. Yes, it is. So that's a good question. So this one is itself. This pinched surface is not a smooth manifold. But the total space is. So I didn't. I ran out of time and didn't tell you exactly how this goes. But here's what I wanted to show you. So what's going on here is that the local picture near that pinch point is something like this. You have C2, so that's four real dimensions. Okay? Your map to the base looks sort of in that local region, just like the map from C2 to C, which takes two complex coordinates and multiplies them together. Now, when you look at the fibers of that map, what happens is that, if we're solving, ZW equals T, well, then if T is non-zero, then, if I'm given, so T is fixed, and now if I fix Z, any non-zero complex number, I can solve for W. And so what I get is just C star, which is somehow I want to represent as a sort of, as a cylinder. It sort of goes off to plus and minus infinity. On the other hand, if T is zero, then I'm solving ZW equals zero, and the solutions are Z equals zero or W equals zero. So that's two copies of a complex plane. So I'll just sort of draw a disk. Here's one copy of the complex plane, and then you have another one. And let me just sort of draw kind of one real dimension of it, and it just meets that one at the origin. And that's actually what's going on at those pinch points.